16th, 2023, and we're hearing our calendar via the Zoom platform. I am joined this morning by my colleagues, Judges Wheelock and Hallbrooks. We're now ready for the third and final oral argument on our calendar. The case is Housing and Redevelopment Authority of St. Cloud Respondent versus Morris Royston Appellant, and the file number is A221386. I see we are joined by counsel for both appellant and respondent. Welcome to you. I just have a few notes before I turn things over to you to hear your arguments. Appellant will have 15 minutes for argument. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have an opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. The time is being counted down for you by a clock that should be visible to you on the screen. If you can see it, can you both nod? Yes, okay. So keep an eye on the time as it appears on the screen. We are making an audio recording of your arguments today, and that recording will be available on our website shortly. In order to ensure that the recording is of good quality, I just ask that when you're not speaking, you please make sure that you're muted so that we don't have any interference. And then I also ask you to please introduce yourselves when you begin your arguments and identify the party you represent. With that, I will turn things over to counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Frazier, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Walter Burke. We're staff attorneys with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and our organization helps veterans avoid homelessness. We're here today representing the appellant, Morris Royston. My client was the defendant in the underlying eviction action and is a tenant in a residential property owned by the respondent, Housing and Redevelopment Authority of St. Cloud. At issue in this case is whether the respondent has strictly complied with the mandated requirements for service of process by Minnesota Statute Section 504B.331D. This is a matter of law for this court to review de novo. The plain language of the statute is clear and unambiguous, and it establishes a number of preconditions that must be met before posting of an eviction summons can be undertaken at a defendant's home. In Kosky versus Johnson, this court reaffirmed the longstanding precedent that a plaintiff must strictly comply with the statutorily prescribed steps for service of process where a statute modifies the rules of civil procedure. As a matter of law, the district court erred in hearing this case because the deficient service of process deprived that court of personal jurisdiction. Therefore, appellant is here today asking this court to dismiss the case. The district court erred in disregarding the plain and unambiguous language of the statute. A plain language reading of the statute requires that words and phrases be construed according to the common rules and approved uses of grammar. Minnesota Statute Section 504B.331 generally governs the requirements for service of process in an eviction matter. Personal service is the preferred method for service in the same matter as other civil actions. However, the eviction statute also provides for two alternatives to personal service. Regardless of the method a landlord utilizes for service, a family can still be evicted from their home in as little as 7 days, making Minnesota's eviction process among the fastest in the country. In this case, the respondent attempted an alternative to personal service under Section D of the statute. Under that section of the statute, a landlord may utilize service by posting if and only if the landlord has first undertaken two attempts at personal service, has mailed a copy of the summons to the defendant at their last known address, and has signed and filed the requisite affidavits with the court.
Ms. Frazier, I understand that you are arguing that the plain language of the statute imposes a temporal requirement for service. And I understand respondent's argument to be that the plain language of the statute imposes no temporal requirement, but simply lists off the things that must be done in order for service to be effective by posting. You're both arguing, I believe, that the statute is unambiguous. Is the fact that we've got two attorneys arguing opposite interpretations of the same statute a suggestion that perhaps the statute is ambiguous after all?
I think that could be potentially grounds to find that the statute is ambiguous. However, I think if you apply the rules of grammar that establish a common meaning among everyone using this language, that the statute itself is not actually ambiguous. The respondents' paraphrasing of the statute to make their plain language argument does rewrite a few critical parts that the legislature enacted to establish this temporal or sequential nature to the statute, and that is in the conditional structure and where they place the conditional article and if, placing that after the 7 days or the 1 week time requirement, and then also differentiating between the conjugations of the verb tense. In the preconditions, the present perfect verb tense is used, indicating an action that has been or state that has been completed at some time in the past. That's distinct from the verb that's conjugated in the main clause. And I believe that clearly establishes that these preconditions must have been met at some point in time before posting can be undertaken at the property. And so the structure in the conditional sentence and the conditional article, along with the verb tenses and the distinction between the preconditions and the action in the main clause of posting, establishes the temporal requirement in the plain language of the statute alone.
So respondent is arguing, this court doesn't make policy decisions. It's our job to interpret the statute by first looking at the plain language. But let's assume that we determine that the statute is ambiguous, and we are looking at the different things that we're allowed to consider in interpreting the legislature's intent. One of the policy arguments that the respondent is making is that your interpretation would actually afford tenants less notice, potentially, of an eviction action. And I'm wondering what your response to that is. Is there any upside for tenants to your interpretation?
Sure. So the upside to this interpretation is that there's more chances for the tenant to receive personal service or a more reliable method of service. So the preconditions have more what is seen as more reliable attempts at service in the personal service attempts, as well as the mailing that can be undertaken before posting, seen as the least reliable. I think if the respondent's interpretation were adopted by the court, then it would ultimately result in less notice, because in situations where the tenant didn't receive actual notice, didn't see the posting in time, those cases are dismissed. Now they're dismissed without prejudice, so the landlord can still bring that case again once we're sure and can be rest assured that the defendant has received notice and their procedural due process rights are protected. Tenants have a constitutionally protected right in their tenancy and in their home, and the procedural safeguards established in the statute themselves, I believe protecting those is avoiding the harm. And so the harm itself is by not enforcing these rules in a way to where all these preconditions must be met before posting takes place. I'm sorry, did that answer your question? Your question, Judge Gages? So as we have discussed, the conditional structure as well as the verb tenses in the plain language clearly establishes that these preconditions must be strictly satisfied before the plaintiff has the right to post. And even reading the light in the record most favorable to the respondent in this case, the act of posting could not have been undertaken under the plain language until August 30th, when the declaration of counsel was filed stating the documents had been mailed. And all of the preconditions were met at that time. So even reading the facts in the light most favorable to the respondent, posting took place 5 days before mailing and filing of any affidavits. And so finding that service was proper under the statute in this case would ignore the plain language of the statute and also render those protections enacted by the legislature themselves meaningless. The district court did not acquire personal jurisdiction absent strict compliance with the eviction statute in this case. In Kosky versus Johnson, this court held that strict compliance with the eviction statute, is required for a trial court to exercise personal jurisdiction over a defendant in an eviction action. And absent that strict compliance, the matter should be dismissed. Strict compliance.
It looks like Judge Hallbrooks has a question, but she needs to be given co-hosting privileges, Jamie, in order to unmute herself.
Thank you. Sorry. And sorry to interrupt you, Ms. Frazier, but I'm not sure that Kosky is that helpful here. I mean, that was a case that talked about substantial compliance versus strict. And, you know, this court decided that strict compliance was necessary. But as Judge Gaetis pointed out earlier, I mean, it is true that all of these conditions were satisfied in this case. It's just not in the order in which you allege they should have been, correct?
Correct.
So there's strict compliance in the sense that all of these conditions were satisfied.
All of the conditions were satisfied. I don't think that that would be strict compliance because they were not satisfied before posting. I think that's where we get more into that substantial compliance that this court held was not sufficient in eviction statutes. And Kosky versus Johnson stands for the principle of strict compliance with the eviction statute, but you are correct. It doesn't touch on the sequence of the statute underlying it itself. But that issue was not in front of the court in that case.
And because in Kosky, there was at least one step that had not been satisfied.
Correct. However, I would note in Kosky, the defendant received actual notice of the action and acknowledged that action or that notice in court. So just as in this case, the defendant had actual notice of the preceding action and showed up in court, and the court still held that the procedural safeguards exist for a reason and they exist to protect the procedural due process rights that tenants have in their home and can be removed in as little as 7 days without actual notice. So I do think that even though Kosky is not directly on point with the service defect in this case, it is still extremely helpful in showing us that even with actual notice, substantial compliance is not sufficient.
Counsel, given the conversation that just occurred with Judge Hallbrooks, would it be your position that if we were to agree with your argument that this would merit a precedential opinion? And if so, what would the syllabus point be?
Sure. I think, you know, a precedential opinion could be helpful. There is a real policy importance in having clear directions to the lower courts and to, you know, practitioners that practice in front of them. Before Kosky, there at issue wasn't the sequence in the statute, so that wasn't dealt with in the holding. And so the syllabus point, you know, for this case, I think would be that there are preconditions that must be strictly met before service can be undertaken by posting.
Respondent's brief indicates that in practice, at least in the metro area, practitioners have adopted your interpretation of the statute. And I'm just wondering if, I mean, not that we can consider things outside of the record, but I'm just wondering what your response to that statement is.
Sure. You know, I don't think that practitioners in the metro have just adopted the sequence, even under the housing court rules. The housing court rules themselves were amended after the passing of this eviction statute to be in compliance with the statute. So that the metro has the sequence that's not in statute, I think is a misreading of the housing court rules in line with the eviction statute. I think what differs in the metro is the number of affidavits that have to be posted. I don't think it is distinct in the sequence that is required, but how that must be attested to. Housing is a fundamental right that should not be lost without proper notice, and tenants have a property interest in their tenancy. Specific statutory requirements were put in place to protect against the inherent dangers of allowing a landlord to force a family from their home in as little as 7 days and without proper notice or without personal service. As a matter of law, the district court erred in hearing this case because they were without the personal jurisdiction to do so. The meaning of the statute is clear and unambiguous, and this court does not need to look beyond the language enacted by the legislature to find or to overturn the district court and dismiss this case. And I would take any additional questions from the judges at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And now we'll turn things over to counsel for respondent. You may begin your argument whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. My name is Isaac Hawkinson, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the Housing and Redevelopment Authority of St. Cloud. The respondent in this matter is the Public Housing Authority for St. Cloud. We're in the business of providing affordable housing to tenants. We're not in the business of eviction. When we seek an eviction, it's for the protection of other tenants or management. When there's a risk to other tenants in violation of a lease, as we did in this case, where there is illegal activity and substantial damage to the property. This case pits two interpretations of 504B.331D against each other. It's not lost on me that both parties in this case are arguing that the statute is plain and unambiguous, and that could potentially mean that, well, there are two reasonable interpretations and maybe the statute is ambiguous. However, I think it's important to look at why there are two interpretations. In my brief, when we cite to the fact that practitioners in the Twin Cities metro area have adopted appellant's interpretation, it's really tenants' rights organizations. And for good reason, they're representing their clients. And with that interpretation, it is easier to get procedural dismissals rather than cases decided
on
their merits.
So it sounds like you acknowledge that there is a difference maybe in practice between what's happening in the Twin Cities and what's happening in your area.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there is a slight difference. However, it's not across the board. And to pretend like it is, even in the Twin Cities, I think would be inaccurate. And I really have no data to support that. It would be only in my practice.
Would you agree then that a precedential from the decision from this court would be helpful to practitioners in determining exactly how to carry out service in these cases in a uniform manner?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I do think the difference can be entirely attributed to the housing court rules, which, and I don't want to get bogged down in a discussion of the housing court rules because they're not at issue in this case. What's at issue is 504.
Well, they could potentially be if we find that the statute is ambiguous, right? I mean, that's one consideration for this court, potentially.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't think the housing court rules determine how a statute, the correct interpretation of a statute. The fact that there is a housing court rule, I think, colors that interpretation. There's not a housing court rule for every part of Chapter 504B. There happens to be one for this one that does not make it right. I think the plain and unambiguous language of 504B.331D does not require in any way the specific order that appellant puts forward as being strict compliance.
Your brief actually goes a little further than that and says that appellant's interpretation of the statute would produce absurd results or is absurd. And I'm just wondering if you could illuminate for us what those absurd results would be.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As this court held in Koski, strict compliance with 504B.331D is required if you are going to serve by posting. What would be absurd is the fact that if you adopt appellant's interpretation of the statute, it's actually going to be providing tenants less notice. The purpose of strict compliance, and I will grant that if the statute is ambiguous, that these considerations should be given more weight. But the purpose of strict compliance with the statute, especially a service statute, is to give the defendant in the case more notice of a coming action, more time to get an attorney, more time to negotiate a settlement, more time to prepare defense. That would be absurd to interpret the statute to provide less notice to a tenant of a coming eviction. It helps no one. There's no benefit to it, to the tenant. So if you decide for appellant, you might
Well, would it be a benefit to the tenant not to have a publicly posted notice if in fact the tenant was, you know, capable of being served, capable of being found in the county?
Your Honor, the minute I file an eviction, that's public knowledge. Anyone in the world can, and with MCRO, it's even easier than ever to see the documents online.
Well, is it posted, I mean, in a building when you file the eviction action?
It is not. So let's say it was posted day one before personal service has been accomplished. And let's say it's posted, and no one would argue service has yet been accomplished, but let's say, you know, it could be a little embarrassing. Sure. What it does, though, let's say the tenant's out of town. Let's say they're at work during that time. And let's say, you know, their neighbor comes by, sees there's eviction notice. What is that neighbor going to do? The neighbor's going to give that tenant a call and say, you know, Bill, whoever, you got an eviction notice. You got to do something. You got to get an attorney. It just increases the chances that that tenant gets more notice of a coming eviction. And if we're going to think about the embarrassment of having an eviction filed against you versus giving someone more notice of a lawsuit, I think that's, you know, when you balance those two considerations out, the fact that you get more notice has to substantially outweigh the public embarrassment of getting an eviction, especially one that hasn't been decided by a court of law yet.
Well, what about something beyond embarrassment? What about the potential for harassment by a landlord? And I'm not suggesting that your organization would do that, but couldn't the statute be interpreted to afford some protective measure against harassing an individual by posting something before all of the procedural requirements have been met and that has been certified to the district court?
Your Honor, posting, you know, a service of process is considered harassment. Well, I don't know what we're supposed to do about that. The potential for harassment, I think, is quite low. It's not like you don't, in an eviction, the court issues the summons. So it's not like there's not an eviction filed. It's not like the landlord is making something up. The summons, it comes from the court. The hearing is set. Service of process must be accomplished with, you know, as soon as you can to let, or, you know, preferably as soon as you can to let the parties have notice of the coming hearing. Does that answer your question? So appellant makes what I would describe as a grammatical argument. And I think you could even, if we're looking at the statute as unambiguous, you could even take appellant's grammatical argument and still fine for responding in this case. Appellant argues that these are preconditions to the literal act of posting. That I think is simply not supported by the statute. They're preconditions at best to when a posting constitutes service. It's, you know, they're boxes that you have to be checked. They are bullet points. You know, it's like jumping a car, for example. You know, appellant is saying, well, you gotta put the red cable on first on the dead car. No, you and I both know that as long as the red is hooked up to red and the black is hooked up to black on both cars, the conditions are satisfied, the car is going to start. There's no particular order that you need to go in to accomplish service under the statute. As long as they're done and they're done timely, posting is not just... it's a way to serve process, and it's a necessary way in the context of evictions where the timeline is so constrained and short to accomplish this. The court can't issue a summons more than 14 days out. So, you know, it's a necessary and it's an available way to serve process in eviction. And a respondent in this case complied with those conditions to serve process correctly. In this case. So if the court is to consider the statute ambiguous, and arguably there is an argument that it is, because in other contexts, and I don't have a specific example, but in other contexts, the legislature, when they want to indicate an order of operations, they'll put in language like must first or shall first, or and that simply isn't present here. So I do believe that respondent met all the conditions necessary to accomplish service by posting. In this case, I believe respondent has the correct interpretation. It is an interpretation that's used all across the state. You know, I practiced in a number. I'm not a 20 year veteran attorney or anything, but I practiced in a number of counties around this great state, and it's the interpretation that I see used. And so I just don't think that what appellant puts forward as this is the interpretation and there's no other way to read it, I just don't buy it. I just can't believe that so many people read it the way that respondent does. And the reason, you know, including sheriff's departments and the district court in this case, the reason it's read the way that respondent reads it is because, well, number one, that's the way it reads. But number two, it provides nothing to tenants to read it the other way. It adds another trip to the property for the sheriff, for the process server, a third trip. And I should note that if that third trip is made after two attempts of personal service is already made, they're not attempting to serve process at the third, personally serve process at the third trip to the property. The process server, the sheriff, is merely there to post the documents.
Does the sheriff have to post the document? I mean, does the statute or anywhere else require that that the sheriff be the individual engaged in that particular act?
No, Your Honor, but I would, I guess 504B.331A believes that or states that any person who's not party to the party to the action can serve it. So, you know, does the sheriff have to be the person who does the literal posting? If you're already paid the sheriff service fee, certainly makes sense to have the sheriff do it.
And what you're saying is it can't be the landlord who posts, right?
If they are party to it. Yes, the landlord can't serve process if they are bringing the eviction. I think that is not at issue in this case. I guess what I would add to this is only that the respondent in this case strictly complied with the statute. Koski held that strict compliance is required, and for good reason. We want tenants to have as much notice as possible. It's better for the system. It's better for tenants. It's better for landlords. It's better for the sheriff's department that doesn't have to run around. And it's not an absurd interpretation of the statute to interpret it the way that landlords do and that many tenants do as well, and courts. It's not... This, you know, there's more to the law than grammar, I guess, is what I would end on. And I'm happy to answer any more questions, but if there's none, I will cede my time.
I see no other questions. Thank you very much for your argument. And we'll get the clock reset here. Ms. Frazier, if you'd like to give rebuttal.
Great, thank you. I'd first like to start by pointing the court back to a canon of construction that is pointed out in Minnesota statutes, section 645.08, that states that a plain language reading requires words and phrases to be construed according to their common and approved usage and the rules of grammar. I think the rules of grammar are significant. They form a common understanding for the rules of language so that we can all, you know, read something and have a common understanding. That's the goal of our statutes, so that people can have common understandings of the law, and that is the role of the rules of grammar when they apply so clearly. The statute does allow for service by posting as a necessary method of service. I agree with the respondent in that case. However, I disagree that the preconditions are just boxes that need to be checked. They are methods of service that are attempting to get notice to the defendant in a more reliable manner than that of posting that have to be done before posting can take place. And that posting, I do think in the structure of the statute is contemplated in a third trip. It doesn't have to be by the sheriff as Judge Gaetis pointed out, but that third trip increases the chance that the sheriff or the process server, whoever, will run into someone that resides at the property that could get the defendant that notice without all of their neighbors knowing the papers have been posted. As far as absurd results, I would like to respond to that quickly in that the respondent's stated reading of the statute, I believe, would allow for mailing of the summons to take place the morning of the hearing and then having those affidavits filed the morning of the hearing. I think that is an absurd result that would not have been contemplated by the legislature in this language and is part of what shows that these preconditions exist. I also would like to reply to another point made by the respondent about the public record of the court documents that are in MCRO or online and can be found at the courthouse. I think it's important that there's a step of separation between the documents being posted on a door or on the court's public website. The neighbors would need to know the tenant's name, perhaps a date of birth, if there's multiple people with that name, to find those documents, instead of just seeing court documents when they're coming home from their own work day. In those documents, there could be unsubstantiated claims that have not been tested in a court of law and then impact an individual's tenancy, both from their landlord and now from their neighbors or anyone else that could have walked by to see those documents be posted. And as far as the third trip goes, it is, you know, I would agree that it does not have to be another attempt at personal service, but just the posting. Okay, and Grant, and there's one last case that I wanted to point the court to. It's not in my brief. However, the case is Green versus Lindsay. It's a US Supreme Court case from 1982 interpreting a Kentucky eviction statute. And you know, I don't think it's on point for this case. We have Minnesota case law, Minnesota statutes, but what I do think is important is that the Supreme Court has noted that posting at, or service by posting in an eviction is constitutionally suspect. It's allowed to allow, you know, for the landlord to make service, but it's the least preferred method. It's already constitutionally suspect. And that's why these procedural requirements exist. They're procedural safeguards to protect the procedural due process rights that tenants have in their tenancy. And with that, you know, I would ask the court to view the plain language, see the conditional structure, and dismiss this case, overturning the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Case was well argued and is now submitted to the court. We will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. The argument itself is now concluded and our oral calendar is also concluded. We will be shutting down the Zoom momentarily and the judges will be convening to conference our non-oral cases. Thank you all very much.